This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Pressing Matters is a show that looks behind some of the headline stories. One of the big headline stories, because this last couple of weeks, has been the Calais jungle. But it's part of a larger story of refugees. I think one that hit and made a big splash almost a year ago when Europe experienced an influx of Syrian refugees. But it's an old story, and one that perhaps can be traced back to the Second World War, when institutions like the Human Rights, the UN High Commission for Refugees was set up. To help me in this conversation is Masjaliza Hamza. She's a journalist and human rights activist who volunteered with the charity Help Refugees in Calais just a few months ago. And with us also, Shaila Koshi, assistant news editor at The Star. She's also a Suhakam awardee for human rights reporting. And she went to Germany last year on a trip sponsored by that government to understand their refugee problem that happening just after the big Syrian refugee crisis that also made headlines for weeks on end. Shaila, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Thank you.
Okay, very quickly, I want to start with you, Mas, and your experience. I mean, people, we often see these stories on television, we read it in the newspapers, but you had first-hand experience. I know you worked in something called The Warehouse, cooking food for thousands of refugees. Could you just tell us, what is it like to be on the ground on a story like this?
I think in some ways, working in the warehouse, you are surrounded by volunteers. So there's a lot of goodwill. There's a lot of people who are there basically to help because they feel that their governments are not doing enough and they want to help as individuals, you know, and all that, and to help refugees. So when you're in the warehouse, you're actually not in the jungle itself. The jungle is a good 30 minutes walk away from the warehouse. But you know that whatever you're preparing and whatever you're doing, whatever your task is for the day, whether you are chopping onions or coriander or whatever and preparing salad, is going to go towards the people who are in the jungle who don't have access to a lot of things, food being one of them.
Shaila, you know, there's a lot of fatigue, I think, among people when they read these stories of the plight of, you know, masses of people in foreign lands. Is the jungle a story that you were particularly interested in, having had that experience in Germany and being a journalist as well as somebody concerned with children who were identified very early on in the story as being a demographic that was particularly vulnerable in the Calais camps?
Yeah, going to Germany definitely opened my eyes to the problem, because we visited many different types of shelters. And you see the children there, and, you know, like meeting the kids, some of them, they're young. Those who are with their families, they look different. Those who are alone, we had asked questions like, could there have been a possibility of, you know, any form of abuse, because they're all young boys, and the volunteers tell us they don't want to talk about it. So then you wonder about how do they integrate later, or will they get to integrate, or are they going to be sent back to their home countries? So it's a dangerous situation. A lot of families are basically surrendering their children to smugglers, because these are not legal routes that they're coming by, and they're traveling 2 months on the road. But one positive thing we saw was that a lot of these kids, by the time they've traveled through all these countries, they've picked up all those languages.
Speaking of languages, I think the name Calais Jungle comes from the name given by Afghan refugees. It's a derivative of, or it's a word that they refer to. They use the Pashto word for jungle. They gave it to that. Did you ask people, Amas, when you were there, why it was called the jungle? Apart from perhaps the presence of a lot of wild animals and danger stalking everybody, you know, at every turn.
Sharon, unfortunately, I did not. I did go into the jungle. In general, the charity that I volunteered for, they actually discourage people to go to the jungle.
And why is
because
that?
Because in many ways, the jungle is, quote unquote, like a jungle. It's an area that is, you know, where you cram like about 10,000 people in under conditions that are on many standards, especially in Europe, is not humane. You know, you don't really have proper toilets. People are living in camps or in shacks. If you're lucky and you come with your family, then yes, you live in container houses. But that came much later. And what happens is that, you know, there's no rule of law per se. It's not a proper refugee camp as we've seen that are run by UNHCR, for example, really nice white-coloured or blue-coloured tents, etc. These are like, it's makeshift, you do it yourself. And what the charities do is that helped make that area, and I thought, you know, there are various Facebook groups that bring together people who volunteer as well as people who are refugees that are living there. And one of the volunteers actually said this, and I thought it's like really apt. What the volunteers are trying to do is make hell more livable. And that's what it's like in there. You know, UN people who have gone down to the camp, to the jungle, actually said it's one of the worst places that they've seen just in terms of living conditions, etc. So in that sense, for me, like, I didn't know that, you know, the information that you said was something new to me. I thought it was a jungle because it's just an area that's like, that has brush lawless. And yeah.
Okay, you know. So just give our listeners a sense of, you know, who was living in the jungle as of July this year, because the camps have been closed now. But it's one of many times that this camp has been closed. It's not the first time it's been closed. Just to give you a sense, 36% of those living there were from Afghanistan, 32% were Sudanese, 8% Pakistani, and then you have a number of Eritreans, Iraqi Kurds, Syrians, 2% from Iran, Kuwait, and other countries. So again, you know, what was this camp for? What? How did it function for the refugees? What were they trying to do by getting to this camp, Melissa? Mas?
It's basically, you know, if you understand the geography of Europe, France is right next to this big island called Britain, right? And Calais...
Big in terms of its ego, yeah.
Great Britain, quote-unquote. Yeah. Calais is a port town, and it's right across the Straits of England from Dover. So it's only like something like, I don't know, 20-something miles, just in terms of imagination. You're so near to Great Britain, quote-unquote, and you want to go there, but you're stuck in this place. And the people who are in the jungle actually are not contained, you know, like there's no proper fence for, quote-unquote, the area that demarcates where the jungle is. The fences are actually built along the highways, built along the coast, etc., and to stop people from the jungle who are in more ways than one fairly have some freedom of movement, but to stop them from getting on the highways, jumping on trucks, etc., that are making their way to the ports and onto the ferries and over to the UK.
Okay, so UK was the kind of final destination for many of the refugees. Shala, when you went to Germany, clearly, you know, at that point, and Angela Merkel, the Chancellor, had already had this expansive and rather seen as rather generous policy towards refugees. But there must have been some blowback from German society. All Germans couldn't, tell us, you know, were Germans necessarily with Angela Merkel in her policy towards refugees?
A lot of the people in government that we met, and, you know, they took us to a few of their offices, like the Foreign Ministry, the Interior Ministry. Everyone sounded earnest, you know. And I went there with a bunch of Asian journalists from various countries. And the thing that struck us was they seem to understand human rights in a very different way, you know, maybe because of the countries that we come from. We're so used to restrictions and getting half a right. But with the Germans, it was like, what do you mean? It's a human right. What are you talking about? It's as though they didn't understand our questions.
They had signed on to the International Convention on Refugees, the Rights of Refugees?
Yeah.
Unlike us, unlike Malaysians.
Unlike Malaysia, sure. Yes. The people, it depends on where you go. Okay, Berlin seemed a little bit more chaotic because they also took us to a town called Schwerin, which is up in the northeast. And interestingly enough, this is part of the old East Germany. So they were a little bit concerned there that maybe the former East Germans would not be as welcoming to these people. But, you know, compared to what happened at Calais, the shelters that we saw in Berlin and Schwerin, even if the first shelter we went to was actually in Hitler's old airport, the Tempelhof airport, where they were housed in hangars. So it seemed like a bit of irony, refugees coming into Hitler's old airport. That didn't look good at all. And because they're hangars, you don't have toilet facilities. So they had to bring in, you know, the mobile toilets. But that doesn't mean you get showers. So when the people came in the first instance, it was terrible, according to the volunteers and the charities that were running the place. Then we went to an old exhibition hall. Exhibition hall is different. So the facilities, your treatment varies according to that. Those in houses were the best.
Okay, so against an attempt to make a hellish condition a little better for people. We're going to be right back on Pressing Matters after this, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, and Pressing Matters continues with me, Sharad Kutan, and my two guests, Masjaliza Hamza and Shaila Koshi. Talking about local populations and their feelings, and this, of course, in some ways might reflect on national policy and the leadership of that country. We have a clip from the mayor of Calais, Natasha Bouchain, and she had her response to what was happening in her city.
I'm taking part in this protest because I'm the mayor of this city, and every day I see human drama, and both locals and the economy are suffering. We want the camp to be demolished to protect the locals and the foreigners who pass through the port. We are here because the government has failed to do enough to avoid this influx of millions of migrants. I have fears for the lives of the population.
You know, there was the mayor of Calais speaking about local concerns. There were, of course, commentators following the destruction of the camp, the Calais jungle, as it was called, that they've just pushed the problem to some other place. I mean, you destroy the camp and people are just moved elsewhere. So perhaps, again, one of those, the politics of not in my backyard. But, Mas, what did you feel on the ground? Did you speak to locals? Did you have a sense of how they viewed this? Because it must be quite unsettling to have thousands of people, kind of march into your city and set up camp.
I think, Sharad, let me just say one thing first. One is that if I were a journalist covering that press conference, I would ask the mayor of Calais, if you say you're afraid of crime, etc., can you give me statistics? The refugee situation in Calais has been around for, in terms of numbers. If you think about a year, has crime increased? That would be one question I would ask. Two, in terms of how people on the ground feel, when I was there, I don't speak any French. In fact, I hardly speak any French, and I speak English. And it would be hard to be speaking in English to a French person. I would just be totally ignored. So in that sense, there's very little interaction between me and people on the ground. But I did speak to volunteers who were from France, who were there in the warehouse, chopping garlic next to me. And these are people who have really good, come with good intentions and want to help and think that the government should do something, should do more. In fact, there is a survey that's run by Amnesty International. It's called Refugees Welcome Index. And it's done this, it was released this year. And it's actually of 27 countries, 27,000 respondents. And if you look at France, yeah, the situation in France is actually quite nice. 9% of the people who responded said they would want them in their homes. It's not even in their country. 73% said they would want them in the country. So if you think about the people, the French people, there may be more acceptance in terms of refugees. People are fleeing wars. People are fleeing famine or whatever that's happening in their countries and coming here. So you would want them... the people want them, but government policy doesn't seem to reflect that,
okay.
which I find strange.
Okay, Shaila, in the German case, we had Angela Merkel, the Chancellor of Germany, saying, yes, welcoming Syrian refugees at an extraordinary level. I mean, these were, I mean, literally over 100,000, right?
800,000.
So, and she had suffered politically. So, Mas, we have a very different situation here, a scenario where the national leadership is making an argument for accepting refugees, but a pushback, at least in terms of some parties that gained against, you know,
within her own party.
Well, what is the conversation you heard there about the question of, you know, acceptance? Was it just the quantum? Was it been okay if it was 20,000 or 50,000, 800,000? Was that the contention?
I think by December, Sharad, they were saying that at least 1 million had come in. But they're all still within the process. You know, you're being registered and you're being processing. So it doesn't mean 1 million will stay. But 1 million did come in. They were not sent out. But if you spoke to the politicians or heard what the politicians said, for them it was a numbers game and how it would reflect upon your votes. That's what they were doing. And I think some of the officials were trying to counter that as well, you know, saying that, no, we have a welcoming culture. You know, our government is welcoming, our people are welcoming. As, you know, I've mentioned to Mas earlier, this in Schwerin, we went to something called a welcome cafe. And it's really interesting. It's set up by charities. There were six in Schwerin itself. It'll be nearby where the houses, where the refugees live, and the refugees are from all over the place. And they come there, and the Germans help them, give them an opportunity to speak in German. You know, because if you want to work or study in Germany, you need to have that language. They help them fill up forms, you know, because if you fill up a form wrongly, you might have to wait another week or a month. And they converse with them, help with the integration process. One thing I found, you know, it's like, we like to think that we know better, but sometimes, you know, so in this welcome cafe that we were, I noticed, and they're all young men, okay? You have some families. They were in, seemed to be walking around each other. And, you know, so I just said, hey, you know, why are you standing over here and they're sitting over there? You know, don't you speak to each other? And the guy goes, the one I was talking to, Saeed, we've now become Facebook buddies. And he said, but I'm Afghani. I speak Pashtun, you know, and they're Syrians, they speak Arabic. God, I felt like a fool.
You know? So the diversity in the refugee population there. Mas, I want to ask you, we earlier touched on the fact that many refugees want to go to Britain. Clearly, they think Britain is better than France, because I think one of the issues with France was that the refugees didn't want to be assimilated into France. They didn't want to be processed to become French nationals. They wanted to go to Britain. What is the conversation across the channel from Calais? Is Britain a welcoming society? Do they want refugees?
Britain is actually a very welcoming society. If you look at the same survey that I was referring to earlier, 1 in 3 Britons surveyed actually said they would welcome refugees in their homes. That's, you know, 29%.
Okay, but how does this square with, you know, all that happened over the Brexit? I mean, one of the biggest issues of Brexit was immigration. They didn't like Polish immigrants. They didn't want, I mean, they were trying to push back on immigrants. Where does the immigrant refugee line lie in debates in Britain?
I think if you read, say, the Daily Mail, for example, then you will find articles that say something like, if minor refugees who are minors are being brought into the UK, then we need to have dental checks to make sure that, you know, that they are actually below 18, because goodness, they've got facial hair, they look a bit like 27. In fact, they even showed photos of a few refugees, which actually goes against international media standards. You don't show faces of minors, right?
Unless
necessary. So they have that, which... But if you read something like The Guardian...
Okay, so the Daily Mail will be like a slightly right-wing British tabloid.
Yeah, some people call them rabid.
Okay, rabid British tabloid. Whereas The Guardian would be what? Kind of left of center, liberal... What is the conversation in The Guardian?
The Guardian has a variety in terms of its response, yeah? And in their journalism, they actually seek out positive stories. They seek out stories that are from the ground, that are good. They show people who are on the ground welcoming the miners, you know, that come in to Britain, as opposed to the ones that are, you know, the ones that are churned out with vitriol, etc., saying, "Not in my town," kind of thing.
Shaila, yeah.
Can I just, you know, back on this welcoming thing, instead of, again, talking about how other countries are welcoming or not welcoming, one of the things from the German trip was for me to ask, how welcoming are we? Because the Prime Minister only said we would take 3,000, you know, and even 3,000. When I came back and I spoke to Malaysians, people I thought were open-minded, but I found, like, the non-Muslims were, no, we don't want them here. And I was appalled because these are good people and these are inclusive people. They said, no, the numbers, again, it becomes a numbers game. Suddenly there'll be more Muslims in the country. But even the Muslims that I spoke to didn't want them to come here. They said, no, la, then it'll be too troublesome. You know, they might be like Saudis and we'll have worse problems here.
So, okay, so Shaila's question, Mas, just kind of quick reflection on how Malaysians think about the issue of refugees. Do you think we're a welcoming society? Do you think that heart of hearts that Malaysians are a generous lot?
Unfortunately, Malaysia was not one of the 27 countries that was called. Otherwise, we would get some indication.
Data.
But I think in terms of welcoming, yeah, just to have a sense of perspective, there are 2.8 million refugees in Jordan, 2.75 million refugees in Turkey. And these countries, Jordan, Turkey, Palestine, Pakistan, Lebanon, South Africa, they only make up 2% of the world economy, but they welcome half of the world refugees, as opposed to the, you know, top five global GDP, which only hosts 9%. I mean, just in terms of numbers, it's staggering.
It is staggering. And this conversation could carry on. It's clearly a conversation we need to have because Malaysia is at the crossroads of a lot of flows of people, some of them refugees, some of them undocumented workers, some of them trafficked. But anyway, thank you so much, both of you. You heard Mas Jalil Hamza. She's a journalist and a human rights activist, and also Shaila Koshi, assistant news editor with The Star. Thank you so much for joining this morning on Pressing Matters. We'll have more with BFM after this. The news is coming up very soon. And then Enterprise, BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.